Someone should treat you alright. Did the Rwanda genocide not end following the April to July rampage in 1994? Was there a U.S. imperial angle to what happened in Rwanda that is not typically spoken about? Who was Paul Kagame and the Rwandan Patriotic Front who supposedly saved the country from further bloodshed? Why were Louis Arbour, General Roméo Dallaire, General Maurice Barile, and other Canadians such a huge part of the story of what happened in Rwanda? This week on the Global Research News Hour, we are examining what is now called the genocide against the Tutsis in Rwanda as they took place starting 30 years ago this week, and arriving at the conclusion that this horrible tragedy was masked to conceal the truth of the actual perpetrators, the RPF, and the victims. In our first half hour, journalist Anne Garrison joins us to elaborate on what her research revealed and about how the current-day Rwanda is a totalitarian regime with no room for dissent on this question. Then in our second half hour, writer and publisher Robin Philpott returns to the show to talk about the 2013 book he wrote, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa. On this week's program, The Truth of the Rwanda Genocide, RPF, the New Instrument for African Imperial Conquest. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of April 12, 2024. The show is funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. I'm your host, Michael Welch. The show seeks to provide listeners with access to analysis of some of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is featured on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. The show was produced on the traditional territory of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation and the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. We honor our Indigenous partners with whom our European ancestors regrettably did not honor in signed treaty and promises. We strive to renew our partnership in friendship and mutual respect and pay reparations in all its forms and to no longer deliver colonialism and genocide ever again. Now it's time for News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Listeners should know that some of the articles may run against common messaging about sensitive subjects and are not all endorsed by this radio station. Your quote-unquote ownership is encumbered as collateral for secured creditors who are the owners in fact. Apparently, this was done by regulatory authorities as underpinning for the derivatives complex, which is many magnitudes greater than world GNP, or perhaps derivative exposure served as an excuse for setting up the Great Reset in which, quote, you will own nothing, unquote. Indeed, individual banks among the world's largest have derivative exposure the size of world GDP. You might wonder why regulatory authorities permitted something so dangerous and irresponsible to occur. To state the bottom line in another way, quote-unquote, your securities serve as collateral for the creditors of depository institutions. That comes from the article WEF's Great Reset, The Great Dispossession, The Loss of Property Rights in Financial Assets, quote, own nothing, be happy, unquote, by Dr. Paul Craig Roberts, posted April 11th, originally published on the Institute for Political Economy. By its own definition, capital as value and quote-unquote life is the opposite of nature as allegedly valueless and dead. From the point of view of nature, however, it is the other way around, as capital is, quote, coagulated former life, unquote, Marx, thus dead by being the result of a killing process, and nature by itself is alive life as such. In reality, living nature is being killed by dead capital instead of capital being alive by transforming dead nature. This inversion, when believed, leads to fetishism. Capital is fetishized as being the better and higher nature, finally valuable and alive. That comes from the article, "There is no, quote, natural capital, unquote, transforming nature, which is alive, into her opposite," by Professor Claudia von Werlhoff, posted April 11th. As well known, Ukraine recently lowered the military recruitment age from 27 to 25, although there are reports of even teenagers fighting on the battlefield. This measure has been considered by experts as a desperate effort to replace the heavy losses suffered by the regime during intense fighting on the front lines. The country's situation is increasingly critical, as there is a lack of skilled people to fight. The constant deaths at the front and mass migration have made the country incapable of maintaining a prolonged war effort, which has worried the regime's authorities. Interestingly, he admitted in his post that the military aid received from the West is not enough to win the war. That comes from the article, "Cannon Fodder, Heavy Losses on the Front Lines. Ukrainians refused to fight, reports of teenagers on the battlefield," by Lucas Leros de Almeida, posted April 11th, originally published on InfoBricks. The Francis Scott Key Bridge collapsed on March 26th, just 4 days after the mysterious attacks in Moscow at Crocus City Hall. We know that gas pipelines were mysteriously blown up in the Iranian provinces of Fars and Shahar at 1 a.m. on February 14th, the same time of day as this collapse. We also know that General Mohammad Reza Zahidi, a senior commander in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps, or IRGC, was killed a few days later in the April 1st bombing of Iranian embassy in Syria by Israel. There are many other unanswered questions concerning this incident that closed down America's vital infrastructure. Before we pretend that nothing happened, before we are convinced to blame the wrong people, let us launch a real investigation. That comes from the article, "Launch an international investigation of the collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge," by Emmanuel Pastriche, posted April 11th, originally published on Fear No Evil.
These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar.
The official narrative of the Rwanda genocide is that it was planned in advance by the Hutu population against the Tutsis, and the UN and the world stood by and watched helplessly as the slaughter raged on. But the Rwandan Patriotic Front brought it to an end 100 days later. So these days we are more concerned not to ever let a narrative like this happen again. In fact, the majority of the killing was attributed to the RPF of both the Hutus and collaborationist Tutsis. And the murder of Rwandan President Habyarimana and the genocide both preceded and followed the 100-day period. Details are found in essential documents such as the Gersony report and Hurugan inquiry, all of which were not taken into consideration by the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda. Why was this evidence so discarded to the point that the Hutu have a bad reputation and the apparent perpetrators are not only praised but remain in power? To answer the question, we are joined by Anne Garrison. Anne Garrison is an independent journalist based in San Francisco Bay Area. Her work has focused on Africa for over a decade. In 2014, she received the Victoire Ingabire Umuhoza Democracy and Peace Award for her reporting on conflict in the African Great Lakes region. It is always a pleasure having you on the Global Research NewsHour, and welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Could you possibly lay out the mechanisms behind which the documentation countering the official narrative on Rwanda was thwarted by the courts and by popular discourse?
The International Criminal Tribunal on Rwanda was a victor's court which tried only Hutu people, although clearly both Tutsi and Hutu were guilty of genocide crime. The International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda, which was controlled by the U.S., indicted and prosecuted only Hutu people. One of the most egregious elements of this, was that the genocide began when two African presidents, Rwandan President Juvenal Habyarimana and Burundian President Cyprien Ntaryamira, were killed. Their plane was shot out of the sky over Kigali, and this happened at a time when Rwanda was enormously tense, couldn't have been more tense. There were a million refugees who had been displaced circling the city of Kigali, the capital, and the plane crashed down into the president's into the grounds around the president's palace. And at that point, several things began at once. The Rwandan Patriotic Front, which was the army led by then-general, now President Paul Kagame, began an offensive to seize power in Rwanda, in Kigali, and the Interahamwe militia began massacring Tutsis. The massacre of Tutsis was said to be long planned, but was in fact more like an explosion in this situation that was like a tinderbox. Kagame seized power. He seized power with U.S. backing, and then the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda was created, and as I said, it prosecuted only Hutus. At several points, and this you mentioned the Hurgan report, the court began to indict Rwandan President Paul Kagame for shooting down the plane, and those indictments were always quashed. Carla Del Ponte was an Italian prosecutor who was going to indict Kagame, and she was fired. Louise Arbour, a succeeding prosecutor, started to indict Kagame, but that investigation and that indictment were also shut down. It's sort of astounding that two African presidents, the Rwandan and Burundian presidents, could be murdered, and there have still been no indictments. Still no indictment, no prosecution. People within Kagame's circle, his closest confidants at the time, including the chief of the Rwandan Patriotic Army and his intelligence chief, they both testify that he ordered the shooting down of the plane. But that hasn't been enough for him to be indicted. He's denying it to this day, even though no one else stood to benefit. Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Yeah, a key player in all of this was the United States. This slaughter was charged up. Had charged up human rights people and found a new basis for humanitarian intervention. What would have been the motive of the U.S. orchestrated plan to this end?
The U.S. was, for one, looking to displace France as the dominant power in the region. The Cold War was just ended. The U.S. was in a supremely dominant position with no power that could challenge its dominance. And so it decided to displace France in the region. And during the war, this is important to understand that the massacres that came to be known as the genocide happened at the end of a four-year war. They didn't just happen out of nowhere, although the massacre of Tutsis in Kigali and elsewhere was largely an explosion. These happened at the end of a four-year war, which began when the Rwandan Patriotic Army, that's Paul Kagame's army, invaded Rwanda from Uganda, where they had been refugees. This is hard to explain. The Tutsi aristocrats had been refugees in Uganda for many decades. They formed an army and decided to invade Rwanda in October 1990. This was barely noticed. The first Gulf War had just begun, and it was barely noticed, but there was then a four-year war in which General, now President Kagame, was fighting to seize power. And in that war, the U.S. was backing him, was backing Kagame, the Rwandan Patriotic Army, and France was backing the existing government and their army. So this was a proxy war between the U.S. and France. Yes. And it was a war for dominance in this region, the most mineral-rich region in the world. Rwanda neighbors the Democratic Republic of the Congo. And 2 years after the conclusion of the war and the genocide, Rwanda and Uganda invaded the Democratic Republic of the Congo, displaced Mobutu Sese Seko, and seized control of the region. They have both been there since. They've been there plundering the minerals since. Minerals leave. They are, for the most part, not processed in Rwanda and Uganda. They're smuggled out to various industrial concerns around the world.
You've reported also on the crimes against dissident politicians and dissident journalists in Rwanda, attempting to correct the record that the exclusive victims of the genocide were Tutsi, and reports on how the vast majority of evacuees to Congo were Hutus fleeing for their lives and not genocidaires.
Genocidaires.
Yeah. Talk about the circumstances that they face today.
It's rather astonishing the degree of transnational repression that this government, the government of Rwanda, is able to get away with. Anyone who seems like a problematic dissident outside Rwanda in the diaspora is likely to be threatened, kidnapped, murdered, or subjected to judicial abuse, meaning Rwanda will go to the government hosting that member of the diaspora and say, this person is guilty of genocide crime, we want him indicted. And foreign governments have been very obedient about that, either because they feel guilty, because the dominant narrative is so dominant, or because it actually implicates them. Any different narrative actually implicates them. Right now, I have been writing about the case of Eric Nshimye.
Yes.
He is an engineer. He'd been working for Goodyear Tire and Rubber for nearly two decades after becoming a refugee. And his only offense, his only real offense to the Rwandan government, is that he testified in the case of another dissident, Jean-Leonard Teganya, who was indicted and convicted in Boston. There's a pattern to these persecutions and prosecutions, these prosecutions which are actually persecutions. There's an indictment, and then the person indicted is charged. Well, they're indicted for genocide crime. They're indicted for immigration fraud. And the claim is that they committed immigration fraud by entering the country without acknowledging that they were guilty of genocide fraud, they were guilty of genocide crime. So then in order to prove that they're guilty of immigration fraud, the court has to prove that they were guilty of genocide, because the immigration fraud is supposed to be that they were guilty of genocide crime, and they didn't declare that on their immigration papers. So you get these what are in effect trials for genocide crime, because to prove the immigration fraud, you have to prove the genocide crime. In this case of Jean-Léonard Tigagne, which was roughly 5 years ago, Eric Nchimie stood up and testified for Jean-Léonard Tigagne, and that made him an enemy of the Rwandan government. This is supposed to make everyone afraid of testifying. Now, I have followed a number of these cases. One of them was the case of Leopold Munyakazi. Leopold Munyakazi was one of the gentlest people I've ever met. He was a professor. He speaks six languages. He's a doctor of philology. He was teaching at Goucher College in Maryland when he gave a lecture in which he said that what had happened in Rwanda was fratricide, not genocide, but fratricide, and a political conflict, because Rwandans eat the same food, have the same culture, speak the same language. So this was actually fratricide rather than genocide, because they're not distinct peoples. Now, whatever you think of that argument, it undermines the genocide argument, which is the foundation of the current Rwandan president's rule. He claims, as he has for 30 years, that he has the right to be in power because he stopped the genocide. That's also a false claim, but he stopped the genocide, and he's the one who has sustained the peace in Rwanda and kept this from happening again, and he has moral standing because he stopped the genocide. So if you say that that's not what happened, whether it's because you have a different interpretation of events, or whether you say something like Leopold said, which was that this was fratricide, not genocide, you're undermining Kagame's right to rule, and you'll be attacked. There was a Human Rights Watch report that just came out, and I have to begin by saying I often disagree with Human Rights Watch, but in this case, I thought they were very spot on, because they were identifying what I said, the threats, kidnapping, outright murders, and judicial abuse that the Rwandan government carries on to perpetuate its rule.
Among the people that you interviewed was the opposition leader, Victoire Ingamire Umuhoza. She's committed to nonviolence and is outspoken against Kagame. She was sent to jail for 8 years from 2010 to 2018. She's unafraid of the threat of assassination. But what, in your experience interviewing her, should we all know about this person?
Well, she's hugely courageous. I don't think I'd say that she's not afraid of imprisonment or death, but she faced it. When she went back, she knew that she was likely to be either assassinated or imprisoned. And she said, okay, I'm going back. I'm going to challenge this regime. She said to her supporters in the diaspora, I'm going back. I'm going to challenge this regime. And I'll throw the first brick in this wall. And if I don't survive, it's up to you to carry on this fight. She does, as you said, she absolutely believes in democracy. One of the things that I marvel about regarding Victoria is that she believes in all the institutions of democracy, rule of law, judicial procedure. She has Well, she went to prison. She went to prison for 8 years for trying to run for president against Paul Kagame in 2010. That's where I came into the story, because I started calling the various candidates who were trying to run for president that year and found they couldn't even get to the point of registering their party or getting on the ballot. The only people allowed on the ballot were straw candidates, and ultimately the president won by 90-some percent. He always wins by 90-some percent. At one point, I think he won by 99%. They weren't allowed to register their parties and get on the ballot. And Victoria was constantly harassed until she was arrested near the end of that year. She was arrested and sentenced to 8 years in prison for what's called genocide ideology, which means that she disagreed with the dominant narrative about what happened in the genocide. What she said was that Hutu people were killed before, during, and after the genocide. She didn't go so far as to use the word Hutu genocide or double genocide, because that is against the law in Rwanda. What she said instead was that Hutu people were killed before, during, and after the genocide, and she called for the prosecutions of those killings to be undertaken as well with regard to the Democratic Republic of the Congo, where Kagame's army invaded and massacred hundreds of thousands of Hutu refugees. She said that the mandate of the International Criminal Tribunal in Rwanda should be extended to the Eastern Congo, where the Rwandan conflict had spilled over. Go ahead.
And we're almost out of time. In the last minute or so, could you maybe share any last thoughts that about the 30th anniversary of the Rwanda genocide that we should all have moving forward?
Okay. One is, I think that the initial story, the story that everyone believes, 800,000 Tutsis massacred by Hutus led by the Hutu government, that's a false story. And I'd recommend several books about it. One, foremost with the most geopolitical context, is Robin Philpott's book, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction. Regarding the imperial fiction, that is that the world stood by and let this happen, and now the world, meaning the international community, the West, most of all the U.S., needs to intervene in places like Libya and Syria, etc. Their justification for doing that is that they failed in Rwanda, so they have to do it there. They claim that genocides were taking place in Libya and Syria. Those are false claims, and the U.S. has no real moral authority to be bombing the rest of the world and so forth. Okay, now Kagame's government is very, very repressive. As I said, it persecutes people in the diaspora, not only in Rwanda. The last time I checked, Rwanda had the second highest per capita prison population in the world, whereas the U.S. has the highest. Many of these people are in prison for quote-unquote genocide ideology, which means having a somewhat different interpretation or expressing some difference about what happened in 1994. And the world is now recognizing how repressive the Rwandan regime is, but they tend to say, well, it's very repressive, he's an authoritarian, but he stopped the genocide and he has overseen this economic miracle. Mm. Now, the economic miracle is a lie.
Okay.
You can read David Himbara, just said, David Himbara has a book, Rwanda's Economic Mirage, which explains that that's not true. Okay.
Okay. Thank you, Anne Garrison. We have to leave it there. Thank you for your fantastic work, and thank you for agreeing to appear as a guest on the Global Research News Hour.
Okay. Thank you.
We've been speaking to Anne Garrison, a journalist based in San Francisco Bay Area and a frequent contributor to Global Research.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Useful Imperial Fiction, is a dynamic and thorough investigation of the major crime in Rwanda. Robin Philpott is the author of the now 11-year-old book. He is a Montreal writer, translator, and publisher. He's written 6 books in French, and he joins us now to discuss his book further. Mr. Philpott, thank you so much for making yourself available on the Global Research News Hour.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael, for inviting me. It's a privilege. It's a privilege.
We appreciate it. So, Mr. Philpott, when and why exactly did you start your research into the Rwanda genocide?
I started doing it during the crisis in Rwanda in 1994. It's as simple as that. I had lived in Africa. I'd studied African history. And even before the plane was shot down on the 6th of April, I was following very closely what was going on, because the major error people make is that they start everything on a date, the 7th of April. As we saw, we're marking the 30 years since that tragedy. And that is the number one mistake, and it is the number one reason, and we can go back and say why there people that is being done, that people are not understanding what really happened. And so so I started working on it then, and I published many articles starting in 94, basically questioning what we were being told at the time. And I had a lot of Rwandan friends who were here studying, we started looking at, you started realizing that there's something more going on than an internal fight in an independent African country. There was more to it. It went on. The book came out originally in French in 2003. And then with time, I ended up publishing it in English, updated, in 2014, it was 2014. It is important that when you look at that crisis, that tragedy, that people realize that what happened in 94 was the result of what had been going on since 1990, when the Rwandan Patriotic Front invaded Rwanda.
Yeah, you mentioned that in great detail in the first part of the book, that since 1990, they were nearly 3 years in advance of what we call the genocide. People in the north were displaced from their homes. I mean, could you explain how this set up the circumstance for the genocide?
Yeah, and I think you have to go back a bit historically, say that, to realize, in fact, what 1994 was, it was the reconquest of power by a minority who had run a feudal state under Belgian colonialism until 1959. And what happened in 1959 was there was independence, and following 1959, and what was known as a social revolution in Rwanda, where with the minority Tutsis is partly the Tutsis, but they controlled everything, and the Hutus were in a feudal situation in Rwanda. There was a social revolution with independence, and certain parts of the population of the Tutsi elite left and went to Uganda, Zaire, which was the Congo, and some to Burundi as well, and so that what happened, it was for finally the 85% of the population started having equality. That was the aim of that social revolution and independence. And as some people point out, Rwanda is the only place in what we used to call Black Africa, where, except for maybe Zanzibar, where there was a revolution with independence, and so what happened in 1990, a group of Rwandan exiles living in Uganda who had helped neighboring President Museveni take power. And they were armed. They were part of the army, head of the military intelligence in Uganda. They formed the Rwandan Patriotic Front in Washington. That's when it was founded. And the invasion was the 1st of October, 1990. And it was very, very violent. And it wasn't a civil war. This army, Rwandan Patriotic Front, was armed and supported continually for 3 years by the Ugandan, by the Uganda, right from 1990 to 1994. So that is the background. And it was quite obvious for many that the Rwandan Patriotic Front just wanted to take power. There were a huge numbers, up to 1.5 million people who were displaced south towards Kigali during that period of war. And the big powers decided, okay, well, you have to negotiate a peace agreement and a power-sharing agreement, which is what happened in 1993. There was the Arusha Peace Accords, under which in Canada you had, not Canada, they created a UNAMIR, which is United Nations Missions in Rwanda, and the person in charge of the military part of it was Roméo Dallaire. It wasn't Canada who put him in there. The United States needed a French-speaking head who was not from France. Mm-hmm. 1990s, you got to remember, the Soviet bloc had fallen, and the Americans were triumphant. And they wanted to take over from France in many places in Africa. France had its own, you'd say its own area, which was, they called France-Afrique. And the Americans wanted to take over from Rwanda, from France. And so that's how Dallaire was appointed to run the military section. He didn't even know where Rwanda was on the map.
Hmm. Yeah. Could you just talk a little bit about Paul Kagame for a second, that his background? Because I'm thinking he's kind of like, the predecessor of Juan Guaido in a way, because, I mean, maybe what was his background and what explains U.S. interest in his leadership?
Well, he was a head of the military intelligence in Uganda. He was sent by Uganda for a training session in Fort Leavenworth under the American Army. He was number two in the Rwandan Patriotic Front. The first one was a man by the name of Fred Rwigema. But he was killed in that invasion in 1990. It was 3 or 4 days after the invasion. And then Paul Kagame he was major at the time. He was head of the Rwandan Patriotic Front, and they called it the Rwandan Patriotic Army, which was more accurate. And so he was the guy who led the war right through to 1990, and he is in power since. He does not tolerate opposition, as we know. Like, we could get into that, but so he was and he is a person who you could say is responsible for many extraterritorial assassinations, responsible for the destruction of the Eastern Congo invasion with a proxy army that's going on right now that we can hear about occasionally in the media. And he's the man who took power. So he is a real dictator. Unlike Guaido, Guaido is like a figurehead, a kind of puppet. Kagame is more along the lines of Netanyahu, Netanyahu, who, by the way, after he took power, about the first place he went in 1996, in October 1996, was to Israel. And there's a famous photo of him meeting the prime minister of Israel, who was Benjamin Netanyahu. In other words, you want to find somebody who's more like an ultra-violent killer. It's as simple as that. That is the description, the best description of Paul Kagame. And his best supporters were and are Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, and the successive American presidents. Right from, it was obvious that the Americans were behind the RPF from the beginning. You know, one of the starting points from my book, and not from my work on this thing, was when I was reading a book by Boutros Ghali. Boutros Ghali was the Secretary General of the UN at the time. And he had a quote there. He said, the Rwandan genocide was 100% American responsibility. He was removed from the UN about a year after or so after that, by the Americans, because then we were having a totally unipolar world at that time. After the fall of the Soviet Union, it was the American century lasted about 10 or 20 years, but that was the period where the Americans ruled the roost totally. And when they did not like people saying, hang on, you have to respect rules and all that. And so, but Boutros Ghali had said that. And the reason he said it, I interviewed him twice, by the way, for the book. And he said, and I said, well, why did that? Can you say that? And he said, the Americans, with the help of the British, did everything they could to prevent the UN from establishing peace in Rwanda. And it was because the Americans wanted a decisive, unequivocal victory of the Rwandan Patriotic Front. It did not want to apply, the Americans did not want to apply the Arusha Accord, which was a power sharing agreement, Dallaire was sent there to apply, which he of course didn't apply, and that's another issue. But that is one of the things that one of my departure points on this book was Boutros Ghali saying that. Well, why? And so how did that work? And that's the conclusion I came to. Now, the use of the word genocide, people can use it. I actually think it doesn't help understand. It doesn't mean that all these killings happened. They did happen. And not only the way people say it. In other words, not only the so-called Hutu militias, but the RPF, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, did a lot of massacring, as some recent books, and I can talk about them later, have gotten into great detail about that. Mm. What is important is the using the word genocide is that, for instance, Rwanda and the Western world mark the anniversary of the tragedy on the 7th of April.
Go ahead. Well, if you just joined us, you're listening to the Global Research News Hour. My name is Michael Welch, and I'm in a conversation with the writer, translator, and publisher, Robin Philpott, on his book, Rwanda and the New Scramble for Africa, From Tragedy to Life, Useful Imperial Fiction. Just to go back, I mean, you were talking about Romeo Dallaire earlier, the force commander of the UNAMIR, and basically, I mean, he's not the only Canadian that's involved in this. There's also Louise Arbour, the Canadian prosecutor. There's the Canadian general, Maurice Baril, a Canadian ambassador, Raymond Chrétien. I think they have more involvement in this, in settling this affairs one way or the other than, I don't know, anything I can recall since. Mm-hmm. Could you explain, you know, a little bit more about how, I guess, the United States is using Canada in this situation? Because I suspect it's more than just, you know, the closemanship between Chrétien and Bill Clinton.
Yeah, no, it's an important point. I'll get back to this question about the peace accord, but the United States, as I said, were triumphant with the fall of the Soviet Union, and one of their secretaries of state, I think it was Warren Christopher, was going around to all the countries where France, basically, it was France's area, France's. The place that France considered there, it had special relationship with African countries, and said, "We don't have any history of colonialism, and we will no longer put up with dictatorship and colonialism." They were basically aimed on taking control of what was considered French, where French influence, areas of French influence, and the British also were agreed with that. In other words, that's West Africa. That's the Congo, Cameroon, where large parts of West Africa that are French-speaking and had this long-standing relationship, sort of neo-colonial, but it was France. And the Americans wanted in, and they made it very clear. And so when this UNAMIR was set up, the United States did not want to have somebody from France or even perhaps from Belgium. They wanted a French-speaking general who was against France. And from if we know Canada, that can be found in Ottawa. It's as simple as that. You can find that in the military, in the judiciary, and in the diplomacy circles in the Canadian government. So that explains why Roméo Dallaire got appointed, because he didn't arrive with a lot of skills in the area. He didn't know where Africa was, where Rwanda was. He admits it in his book. And I think he was a total failure. You know, he said, "Oh, I tried," but no, that's not how it happened. Louise Arbour, she got appointed by Madeleine Arbour, who then got in touch. Then it was the Canadian government they got in touch with the Canadian government. In other words, she got vetted by Madeleine Arbour, who was Secretary of State in the United States, before. They didn't do it along diplomatic circles. They didn't get in touch with Canada. Said, "Have you got a judge you can, or a prosecutor you can propose?" It was the other way around. They started identifying. They wanted to have a French-speaking judge or person who was not necessarily in France. Then Maurice Barry was working in the Peacekeeping Association. And this is one thing that I also got from Boutros-Ghali, that they were operating basically according to the Pentagon, what the Pentagon wanted. Maurice Barry was the one who was communicating with Roméo Dallaire. Raymond Chrétien got appointed when there was the invasion of... He was a man brought in to try and find a solution after there was a huge refugee camps in eastern Congo, and the Rwandan government, the Rwandan Patriotic Front government, was bombing the camps. And the refugees were being massacred, and they had to flee. And so he was brought in to try and find a solution between the Congo, at the time it was called Zaire, and Rwanda, and it was a failure. I interviewed the man, and he and Barry were sort of in Barry. They managed to set up an intervention force that was going to be led by the Maurice Barry. Maurice Barry flew over the area. He said the refugees were safe, and this force intervention, which UN was setting up, was stillborn. This was fall 1996. And anybody who you spoke to who lived there said that sacrificed hundreds of thousands of refugees. people who had to flee to the west of Congo. And there's stories of people, how they walked across the Congo. We published a book, in fact, by one man whose family walked across the Congo on foot. And they were being chased by the Rwandan army. So it's and that is going on up to now with actions by the Rwandan Patriotic Front. If you allow me to just go back on one thing about the 6th of April, this is the date, the most important date. It's not the 7th, the 6th of April, the president of Rwanda flew back from peace talks in Dar es Salaam with the president of Burundi. Their plane was shot down on the evening of April 6th. And in the plane, there was the chief of staff of the Rwandan army and other top military leaders. The Rwandan state was decapitated with that. And that meant the end of the peace agreement. Now, to this day, although everybody knows that it was the RPF and it was ordered by Kagame, his close associates who have fled by the past were there when they planned this assassination. But to this day, there's never been an independent inquiry into it. And people keep a kind of an artistic vagueness about it all. You know,
you talked in the third chapter, the third part of it, you talked about the basically use of the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda as a kangaroo court, you know, because it was very not even-handed and so on. Could you elaborate on the use of the international criminal justice as what you call a battering ram?
Yeah, I wasn't the one calling it a battering ram, by the way. But no, they created this court, which has International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda, and they'd created one for Yugoslavia as well. And they gave all the power to the prosecutor. The reason the term of it used as a battering ram is that was one of their U.S. ambassadors for human rights and international tribunals, who described how he'd managed to organize the tribunal so that it would be a battering ram in the advancement of U.S. and NATO interests. He said that. David Sheffer was his name, and he was one of the American appointees, ambassador at large for it. That's what it was. And the best example is that they gave themselves a one-year period when the crimes had to be committed that they were going to examine. But they only indicted one side nobody in the RPF was indicted. Nobody, and nobody was, when they actually started discovering who shot down the plane, and it was Kagame and his henchmen, the people with him, they started discovering it. Louis Arbour guy put an end to that investigation. In other words, it was 97, if I'm not mistaken. She was the one in charge, and they started finding out this crime was committed on the 6th of April. And yet it was excluded from the purview of by Louise Arbour herself. So the tribunal, and the interesting thing, her successor was Carla Del Ponte, and she said, if it's true that the RPF shot down the plane on the 6th of April, then the history of the Rwandan genocide has to be rewritten.
Mm.
But of course, then she got moved out. She got removed from there. So.
Okay, we only got a couple of minutes left, but I just wanted to say, first of all, in the middle chapter, you highlighted four books, one from United States, one from Canada, a novel from Quebec, and a mother report from Belgium, and they all seem to have that same tendency to, I guess, highlight the remnants of literary thinking going back to Joseph Conrad and his article, his novel. But also, you say that when you look at this monstrous deception and what it led to, you find that the RPF in Rwanda is in the glove of the U.S. and it's propelling towards Congo. So basically, they've turned it into kind of like another Israel in Middle East, as you said, or post-coup Ukraine and against Russia. All while pushing back against France. So in the last 2 minutes or so, is there any highlights that you want to focus on, conclude with to admit that you haven't gotten into in enough detail?
What I would say is that by not looking at why this happened, and those four books help you show that the sort of the racist colonial mentality of people who comment on these events and write about it, that they will reduce it to a question of Africans fighting among themselves and how brutal and bloodthirsty they are. That is what you read. And if you don't go and say, now, why did this happen? How can a sophisticated army be developed and armed and financed and invade a country, and then the powers that be come along and say, okay, you have to negotiate, force the Rwandan government into a corner where they can't stand up, create conditions where you also know that there is a history of conflict among in the population of Rwanda, and basically you add fuel to the fire. You fuel that conflict because of your own interest. And that is what was going on. So we've been through in the last week or so an outpouring of propaganda about what happened there, but none of it, as far as I can see, actually tries to understand what really happened and why and who was involved. And it's like right now, we do not want, what's going on in Gaza right now. Everybody sees it now that it's the Americans who are backing Israel who are killing and killing and killing. You don't want that in 20 years, 30 years to say, well, this was just, the violent Arabs and jihadists who are fighting against the wonderful Israeli population who'd been through a Holocaust. Like that's basically what's happened here. But if people want to understand what happened, you got to start looking. And that is not what our media have done in the last week or two.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. But Robin Philpott, it's been a joy talking to you and discussing your book. Thanks so much for your availability on the program.
Thank you, Michael. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Robin Philpott is a Montreal-based writer, translator, and publisher of Baraka Books.
That's it for now. Join us next week for alternative positions on climate change. You're listening to the Global Research NewsHour, a program funded by the Center for Research on Globalization and produced in collaboration with campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on the traditional lands of the Anishinaabe, Innu, Oji-Cree, Dene, and Dakota, the birthplace of the Métis Nation in the heart of the Métis Nation homeland. The show airs on partner radio stations across Canada and the United States and is available for streaming or download at the site globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I've been your host, Michael Welch. Thanks once again for joining us. Mm-hmm.